Accession number 20671, Reel 2.
Him, and he just passed me over something in a little paper bag, and he said, "That'll do the trick for you." And when I opened it, it was an eye patch. And I told the sergeant, and he said, "Right, stick the eye patch on." And I passed.
So, did they teach you sort of tactics and field training?
Yes, well, first of all, we had to be proficient in various vehicles. So we were taught how to drive the Jeep, the Bren gun carrier, the Bedford 15, the Bedford 3 tonner, right up to, they had a Scammel there, which was used for tank recovery. And that was a monster to drive, that thing. But you had to be proficient in driving these various vehicles. But not tactics as such, I don't think, no. We go out on night manoeuvres. Whereby they'd wake you up at 11 o'clock at night when you just got into bed, and you'd be taken out in a Bedford 15 underweight up to the lower highlands of Scotland and dropped off in groups of three.
Leo Rumley, end of reel one. Leo Rumley, reel two. So you were telling us about a night manoeuvre when they
got
you off at 11.
Yes, and we were taken out in groups of about six, I think, if I remember rightly. And we were told to get out, and we were given a map and a compass, and just told to be back in the unit in time for breakfast at 7 o'clock. And it was pitch black, mountainous, cold, but we managed it, and I think we had about three of those sort of things, and you were marked according to how long it took you to get back again. A bit like homing pigeons, you know, you flew in and and booked in.
So what was your attitude to that? Did people resent it? Did you resent it?
No, there was a great deal of camaraderie and competition between people to say, well, I'm not going to get sent home at this stage, I'm not going to be sent back at this stage. And so you put up with it, and you rather look forward to the challenge. The worst challenge in the marching department was the 10-mile forced route march, and that was really a killer. Because there you had the full kit, including your large haversack, with your blanket and all your eating equipment and spare boots and spare shirt and everything, and a rifle, tin hat. And you had to walk, I think it was 20 paces, run 20 paces, walk 20 paces, run 20 paces for 10 miles. And behind you was the Bedford 15 picking up the stragglers that fell out on the wayside. And you see these marathon runners today coming in after a marathon run virtually on their hands and knees, and it really was like that at the end, but I got through it.
So people were dropping out, were they?
Oh, they were. Oh, yes, every day there'd be people dropping out. Mm. I don't know what the total was, but, I mean, say a couple of hundred of us joined at the start. I mean, I think less than 100 finished.
So people were failing all sorts of different things.
Yes, oh yes.
And if you failed, what happened? You just...
You're sent back to a holding unit, and then you were reallocated to an infantry or whatever, you know, yeah. Or the artillery or medical corps or whatever wanted people at the time.
So what did you say to people who were dropping out, you know, when they were going?
Well, we didn't know, because they'd be told of an evening, and they'd have the kit packed, and they'd be on the... on the truck down to the station at Dumfries.
Just gone.
You know, the next thing you knew was you'd come back from supper at the NAFE, and they weren't in the Nishnut anymore. You know, they'd gone. So
So quite a sort of team spirit and esprit de corps developing.
Oh, indeed, yes. Yeah.
I think that was the intention.
Indeed. Oh, yes. So.
Sheep and goats. So, what other training did you do? Did you radio training?
Well, those people that wanted to learn to become radio operators, which was a specialized operation, they had to become proficient in the Morse code, which was a long, boring, tedious operation and didn't appeal to me at all, so I didn't bother. I stated a preference to become a dispatch rider. So I did about a week or so on motorcycles, and I think I became grade B, I think, on I didn't make the grade A, but I think I made grade B on a motorcycle course. Well, I thought, luckily. So
any other specialised training that you did? Or?
A peculiar thing was that, of course, we were taught unarmed combat.
Tell me about that.
And I think on the second or the third day we were doing the unarmed combat bit. They said, you didn't bother dressing up today, you can just put your fatigues on. We called denims. We're going to Carlisle. So we got on the trucks and we went to Carlisle. And when we got there, went into this huge building. And there was an unusual pungent smell about this place, which we couldn't quite place. But as soon as we got inside, we realized what it was, and it was an abattoir. And they said, this is part of your unarmed combat training. You must get used to seeing the sight of blood being spilt. And so we were paraded to sit and watch them slaughtering sheep by cutting their throats. And that had made a few fallouts as well. If you if you felt a bit queasy, or I mean, some of the lads even just fainted away, you know. But yeah.
So you failed if you fainted.
Oh yes. Mind you, I was at an advantage there because when I was a young boy, in the house we lived at Wellow, was a licensed slaughterhouse. And so I'd actually held pig's ears while they cut his throat when I was a young lad. So it didn't bother me in that respect. But but some of the lads found it really. But that was part and parcel of the unarmed combat thing. And you were taught how to strangle people, how to throttle people.
Who taught you?
The instructors, yes.
At Lockerbie.
At Lockerbie. And they showed you how to use the stiletto, and you count up three ribs up on the left hand side and find the gap between the third and fourth rib and stick it in, and that's it, you know, you're dead between the third and fourth rib.
So how many ways did they teach you to kill people?
Oh, quite a few. Using the, I think what they call them now, where they have a piece of string with two with a, either a stick or a stone at each end, and you can spin them round, and they can either get round your ankle and trip you up, or round your neck and they'll throttle you. We're taught how to use those. Knives, as I say, how to use knives, even how to use the chin strap on a helmet to kill people, to break the neck, the elder lip of the German helmet, and yank it back really quick and hard, it would break the neck because they wore a chin strap underneath. Most British soldiers never wore the chin strap underneath. So the tin hats were always falling off, you see.
Yeah.
But we never wore tin hats when we went into action. We never wore them at all.
Was that your choice, or?
Well, it just seemed to become the thing. We only wore the black beret. That was it.
So what other special training then at Lockerbie? They were training you up like Olympic athletes?
Yes. Well, as I say, we learnt driving vehicles off ramps. And we learned how to drive vehicles. I don't know if you ever couldn't have experienced it. When you've got a tracked vehicle which goes up an incline, when you're doing the climb, all you can see is the sky. And you reach a point where you're going to tip over the top. And it's quite dramatic because you fall at a terrific rate and hit the ground with an almighty whack. And you're supposed to keep control of the track vehicle while you're doing that. And it's a particular skill to get it right.
Yeah. So they taught you that out on maneuvers?
That's right, yes. Yeah. Yes. And
where did you do most of your manoeuvring?
In and around Lockerbie. We did, they had a nice copse of young growing conifers there. And there are irrigation ditches every so far through the conifer forests, and they taught us how to run through these conifers with the rifle held in front of you as a shield against the twigs and what have you, and to pace yourself to leap over the irrigation ditches without stopping. And I remember one poor lad must have tripped on a root or something, and he fell head first into the irrigation ditch, and the lads were just walking across instead of jumping it until the instructor came up.
So you were aware then that you were being prepared as an elite force?
Oh, indeed, yes, mm. Yes, yes.
You got quite proud of that?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Particularly when we eventually joined the regiment, because we joined, I initially joined the 38th Independent Recce, and most of the people that were already there hadn't had the benefit of all this training. They'd been recruited from infantry units and so on. And so, of course, we could boast about all the skills that we had that they didn't have.
So looking back now, on, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, do you think all that training was appropriate, and what was useful and what was useless?
Well, I only know this, that when we'd finished at Lockerbie, I felt as if I was fit and capable of undertaking anything that the army could give you. I still didn't like the marching and the polishing bit about it, but everything else I felt quite able and capable of doing.
So, looking back on your time in Europe, were all those skills useful?
Quite a lot of them were. Yes, yes. And you always knew that if the position ever arose, that you hadn't the ability to do these things, you know.
So you had a real confidence, really?
Oh, indeed, oh yes, he was a great confidence builder, yeah. Yes.
Any looking back, any of those skills looking back that were completely useless and complete waste of time you ever been taught?
Well, I've never had to march 75 miles, I don't think. And in the event, I was downgraded with fallen archers. And I put that down to some of the training we did at Lockerbie. Yeah. It was really hard.
So you did 13 weeks there?
Yes.
And then where did you all go, the same place after that?
No, no. At the end of the 13 weeks, we had a passing out parade. And we were then given envelopes and told where we're going to report to. And I was told to report to the 38th Independent Reconnaissance Unit at Sandwich in Kent. So it went right from Lockerbie right down to Sandwich in Kent.
Typical. So did you get some leave?
Oh yes, after Lockerbie we got some more. I think I got 10 days leave after Lockerbie.
And you came home again?
Came home. And it was a completely different soldier that came home the second time from Lockerbie. Yeah.
You felt different.
Confident.
Did people notice you?
Oh yes, yeah. You wore a uniform with confidence then. And, yeah.
So then off to Kent.
Off to Kent to Sandwich.
Mm-hmm. And what barracks were you in?
We weren't in barracks. In we were in, I think we were in a big school in Sandwich. Mm-hmm. And we moved about quite a bit. Eventually we went onto the south coast on coastal defence.
Mm-hmm. What time of year was this when you went to
So we're talking now about summertime, late summer.
Summer, yeah. Mm-hmm. So what were you doing on coastal defences?
Well, I'd got my DR badge.
DR?
Dispatch rider. And I was a dispatch rider at a little place called Winchelsea. And my job was to go around to the coastal command stations on the south coast, collecting all the information on shipping movements and so on, and take them to the naval intelligence at Dover. Mm-hmm. And that was a daily run that I used to do.
So how far would you go along the
south coast? Well, from Winchelsea, which is near Hastings, to Dover. Mm-hmm. Probably about 30-odd miles, I think.
And how many places would you pick up from then?
About six on the way there. Yeah. We used to go into Hastings, which was going away from there, and then we'd come back again along the coast road, and we'd go to Lydd and various other places, picking up along there.
Do you enjoy that?
Oh, yes, until I had my accident.
Right, so what happened there?
Well, the road down to the coastal command was supposed to be a private road. And I knew this road quite well, having been there every day, backwards and forwards, and I knew the road quite well. And it's Saturday morning, and I'd got my best battle dress on, ready for going out as soon as I'd done the round. And I was coming back from the Coast Guard station, and took this left-hand bend. And halfway around the bend, there was a Bedford 1500 weight truck, which completely filled the road, facing me, coming towards me. Well, I knew instantly if I touched the brakes, I'd have had it. So I tried to change down and to slow down, but I hit this head on, went up over the bonnet, through the windscreen, and out the door, into the ditch. And they took me to a first aid station, and patched me up, and I got back to Winchelsea, and the sergeant said, "How's the bike?" So I said, "Well, it seemed all right, you know, a bit damaged at the front, but it seemed all right." So I was in Dover the next day when they brought the bike in, and it was about the third of its normal length. The front wheel had been pushed up and through the engine. The engine had been pushed up through the petrol tank, and the bike was complete right off. So.
So did you recover from that fairly quickly?
Yes. It was an injury to my leg, more than anything else, and a couple of teeth missing. Mm-hmm. But I was in that bike was a Norton. My love of my life, that old Norton. But the replacement bike was a BSA, a different bike altogether. And I was coming back from Dover on the BSA, and I'd met this Canadian who was on an American motorbike. He was doing the same sort of thing, presumably, as I was. And we're coming back, and I said, "Come on, I'll give you a run for your money." And we were having a bit of a race, and I came round another bend, hit a pothole, went over the top, and that was the second motorbike ridden off.
So were you in trouble for that?
Yeah, I got fined 12 and sixpence, I think, for the loss of the first bike. Mm. The second bike wasn't too bad. I think it only had a bit of damage to it, but I think that was the end of my motorcycling career in the army, yeah.
So you lost your dispatch rider?
Oh, no, I still kept my badge, but I didn't do any more dispatch riding.
Too expensive.
I don't think the army could afford to keep me in motorbikes.
Not really.
So
what did you go on to do then?
Well, the reconnaissance were just taking delivery of some light tanks. So I trained up on these light tanks for a while. And
when you say light tank, did they have a sort of a proper name or?
I, th- I think they were Cromwell's. I'm not quite certain. Looking back now, I can't remember.
So these were new?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So what sort of training were you doing on them?
Well, mainly they never had them before. And, you know, they wanted people to be... So I think the Royal Armoured Corps sent some instructors down to teach us how to drive them and how to manoeuvre them, how to look after them and so on. And then they took them off us and replaced them with armoured cars. So, and we moved about quite a bit, went up to Morpeth and other parts of Northumbria, and eventually we finished up at Scarborough. And we were stationed in these lovely hotels in Scarborough on the Mound. And we did some training on Oliver's Mount with Bren carriers. And I'll tell you a little amusing incident. We were coming back from Oliver's Mount, about six carriers all in line going down the streets. And it was heavy drizzle, really heavy drizzle. And we were miserable because the carriers are wide open. There's no roof on them, you know, they were wide open. And we were all soaking wet through. We were driving along in convoy. And we noticed on the pavement there was this old lady walking along rather hurriedly, on her own, no one else there at all. And as we walked along, we realised that her knickers were slowly going down her leg. And she was shuffling along there. And without pausing, she just stepped out of them and left them on the pavement and walked on with her head up in the air. And all the lads were cheering. But nobody stopped to pick them up for her.
No. So did you have, were you working as teams now? You know, did you have special mates or...
Yes, there was didn't seem when we were in the 38th, there didn't seem to be any pattern of training as such. And when we got to Scarborough, we were told then that the 38th was being disbanded, and we were sent to just outside London. On the coast, the seaside resort at London, North London.
Southend.
And we went to Southend in a holding unit. And my memories of that was that I'd then made friends with a bloke called Wright, and we all called him Soapy because of Wright's coal tar soap, which I still have to this day. And he was a Cockney from the Elephant and Castle. And so every day at Southend, we'd go on 9 o'clock parade, and they would read out all these lists of people, and they were to stay behind, and they would be sent to various units. And if you weren't called out, you were free for the rest of the day. So for 3 or 4 days or whatever long it took, Soapy and I used to get on the train at Southend and book to the next station down the line, Threepence or Fourpence, whatever it was, and stay on till we got to London. And he knew which station to get off at in London, where you could get off the train, go over the bridge and pick up the underground. And we get on the underground, and... no ticket, and we go off at Euston and tell the guard we get on at the stop before. So he said, all right, give us twopence. So that's how we used to go to London every day, and he used to take me around London to the pubs and what have you, you know. So
what you went,
and then of course my name was called out, and I was sent to the 53rd recce.
So are you pleased with that news?
Well, I wasn't particularly bothered. I knew I was going to be in some regiment or other, and I knew then that I was qualified as a reconnaissance man and I wasn't going to be sent to the infantry or the artillery or anything else. So, of course, I didn't reckon on joining the 53rd, because if I hated the bull when it was at training, it was nothing to what we got when we joined the 53rd.
So where did you actually join them?
Ashford in Kent.
Right.
Yeah, so
do
back
you
in
the
Kent.
Days you got there?
I don't know. It was, I think it was November 43.
Mm-hmm.
When I got there.
So what was it like then? Sasha?
Well, the billets weren't too bad.
What sort of buildings were they?
Well, that was an, I think we were in what used to be an old rectory. Mm-hmm. But there were, the main part of the regiment was in an old country house, mansion type of thing, mm-hmm. in this park. And they were really strict on shining everything that could be shone, and everything that couldn't, they used to shine it as well. And everything else was painted white, and they had this cream-coloured blanco, and oh, it was murder.
Really?
Yeah, so.
Do you remember the NCOs there?
Oh, I remember some of them, yes. I still know one or two of them.
Do you remember some names?
Oh, yes, I remember Nobby Clark there, and who was to become my sergeant and a very good friend of mine, Tiny Boys. They called him Tiny because he was 6'9", I think. And we're still good friends today. And some of the officers I got to know, we're still good friends with them as well.
Like who?
Dizzy Cragen, who was the adjutant. And I got Peter Upton, who was a major at the time, and Jack Pitts, who was a captain, who eventually became my officer.
So were you friends with them then, in a sense? So in what rank were
you? Not really, no.
You're still a private?
We're called troopers, not privates. And I just didn't want promotion because I didn't like the NCO setup, really.
Why was that?
Well, because it seemed to me that the sergeants, for instance, had their own mess, and there was only, let's say, 30 or 40 sergeants. And if you didn't get on with a few of them, that's you couldn't do it anywhere else. You couldn't join the corporals or the troopers or the officers or anybody else, you know. And I thought it was rather a closed shop idea. And I prefer to be friends with all and everybody, really, you know. I struck up friendships with one or two of the officers who eventually left, and one or two of the NCOs.
So there was a bit of mixing between ranks then?
On an informal level, yes. There used to be a saying in the army, on parade, off parade, you can be off parade, you know. And as long as there was no compromise involved, I mean, it didn't matter. Mm. Yeah.
So, did you do any, I haven't asked you whether you did any anti-gas precautions or training at any stage?
I hated the we used to have gas drill regularly.
Where was that?
In all the time from the from Lincoln onwards, yeah, we used to do gas drill.
Mm. Which comprised of what?
Donning these horrible capes, putting gas masks on, and when we were at Lockerbie, we were taken into a gas chamber, and we had our gas masks on, and it was just a bunker, really. Concrete walls, concrete floor, and a concrete ceiling, and one bulb, and one door. And they got us in there and shut the door, and we were told to walk round the walls. And in the middle of the floor was this little canister. And after a while, the sergeant said, right, I'm going to light the canister. So he lit this canister, and all this gas came pouring out, and we still got our gas masks on. And we thought, well, you know, so what? So then he says, right, take your gas mask off. Well, it's like committing suicide, isn't it? You know. Anyway, we did, yeah. And then he opens the door and we had to file outside. And by then we were absolutely gasping.
Do you know what the yes was?
CS? No, it wasn't. I forget what it was called now. Chlorine, I think. It used to get you at the throat. And when we got outside, we were all lying on the ground. And he said, right, get on your feet and run up this hill. And we ran all this hill. And we realised, of course, afterwards, that it was absolutely essential to really exert yourself to get rid of the gas that you've got.
Leo.